Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Whether you're just looking to stay warm during a hunt or need maximum concealment, the clothing you wear can make or break a hunt. At MidwayUSA.com, we understand hunting clothing has come a long way with more meticulously crafted camo patterns, advanced scent control technologies, and weatherproof options to withstand the elements. Hunters have to wait until their favorite season, but shouldn't wait on gear, which is why MidwayUSA offers super fast shipping. When you're ready for your next system, log on to MidwayUSA.com.
Welcome back to everyone to another episode of Feather and Fur, your host Brad Hurlbus. Today we have on Emily and Josh from Crappie Junction. Welcome to the show.
Hey everybody.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, I'm excited for this one. I think it's going to be fun. Touch base on a little bit of everything outdoors from some fellow Wisconsinites.
Absolutely.
You know, we can think of summer and fall as we're both dealing with, you're dealing with a snowstorm and I'm dealing with freezing rain and sleet. It's a great way to remember what Wisconsin is when it's nice outside.
Well, fortunately, we're almost into maple season, so that's our saving grace. We're just waiting for that, and we got a few more ice trips up our sleeve as well.
That's what I was going to say, is we still have decent ice, and so I only wanted a little bit of snow for the snowmobile. This is more than I asked for, but we're going to make the end of the season work out.
What are you supposed to get up there? Because the totals have changed so drastically. And this episode, we're recording it. So for everyone that I normally don't say when recording, we're in the middle of a snowstorm. This airs in 2 days. Like, you can catch up.
Yeah, I think last time when we checked was about, 10 to 12 inches. So we'll see. It's supposed to be cold, though. So that's, the powdered snow is usually pretty nice.
Sure. Well, and ultimately, the people at home will know more details than we do at this point.
Because, yeah.
Like you said, by this point, this will be airing.
Did they get 12 inches? Did they get 27? We'll find out. We'll know on Saturday. Because that was the crazy thing with this storm. Like, we're 2 days ago, they're like, well, Madison might get 10 to 12 inches or 1 to 2 inches of slush and a quarter inch of ice. And we're kind of leaning towards that line right now, but not quite a quarter inch of ice. But then just north of me, well, 12 to 24, we don't know.
Yep.
24, that's a big range. Like,
that's a lot of range. Make sure you're right, though.
It does make sure you're right. I mean, you should throw enough darts at the dartboard, eventually you're going to hit a bullseye, right?
Right.
So I'm curious, and normally I start my shows off with asking you how you got in the outdoors, but I'm going to skip that because I want to know about maple season. And I wasn't planning on the episode going this way. I was really planning on, but I have not actually had an opportunity to talk to people about like the full, because I know there is some serious passion there with tapping trees and boiling. Like, I know the process overview, like, because I have some friends that have done it, but I'd love to really hear more about that, because I know that's a huge tradition in Wisconsin.
Yeah, I mean, it ranges anywhere from, mid-February all the way to the end of March, sometimes even into April, depending on the weather. I didn't grow up doing it. I kind of learned it over the last decade, and I've kind of fallen in love with it. Wisconsin has some great traditions. I love sturgeon. I love the maple season. I'm a prairie boy by heart, so I grew up with lots of ducks and lots of like Upland Game and stuff. And then I moved over here, and it's, you know, now we live in the hardwoods. So it's been a transition, but it's super awesome. We don't, you know, do any production. It's just for ourselves and friends and family. More or less just to have it on hand.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
We're really excited because, you know, like Josh was saying, it is our first year doing it on our own. So, you know, there's a lot that we were able to learn from others because it kind of takes a community to do this sometimes, you know. But it is really cool to be able to put all the pieces together and, I guess, go into our first season strong.
That's awesome. And if you haven't had real maple syrup, it's not like what you buy at the grocery store. Even the real maple syrup in a grocery store isn't the same as like buying it from someone that's actually tapping trees and boil. It's different. Like there's bars and like there's supper clubs in the North Woods of Wisconsin that actually have real maple syrup, and there's always an upcharge for it, which is 100% understandable. But if you don't pay it, you're completely missing out.
Yeah, and it really depends on the maker too. You know, I have at my work, I have some of the older guys that still tap. They tapped with their grandma. They'd use a cast iron kettle, you know, and it has like kind of an irony taste. And then we have like, I have friends that do the, you know, the straight stainless steel, like evaporator thing. Like, so it ranges a lot and the taste can range a lot. And it's just something that I really enjoy, like not only just consuming, but like cooking with and using it for other stuff like that.
It's a pretty amazing base for an old fashioned. I mean,
if you don't use
maple syrup in your old fashioned, you're missing out. How Wisconsin can we get in this episode, right?
Right.
It is quite the process, though, to make it, you know. So I don't know if there's people out there who don't know, but I mean, it involves collecting a massive amount of sap from the trees. So, you know, sometimes you drive around and you see people have like little bags hanging off and everything. And, you know, what is the ratio? It takes like 40 gallons of sap sometimes to make syrup, and that varies year by year, but to collect all that and evaporate it down, I mean, it sounds so easy to like boil water and make syrup, but it is really so much more than that.
Yeah.
I actually want to hear more. Like, my episode is outdoors, right? It's not just strictly hunting. It's archery. And we were going to talk about archery. Well, I'm sure we'll get into it, but like, I really like am interested in like different things you can do in the outdoors, right? So I'm curious on that process. I'm like, will you dig into it a little bit? Like why, how do you know when the tree's ready? It's like, why does it produce sap in like end of winter, spring? Like what's unique right now? And then as you collect sap, like how do you process it? Like, I really want to learn here. I'm really curious.
Yeah. So, I mean, it you play it by ear a lot of times. You can, you know, if you keep a really good eye on your trees, you can start to see some of the buds, you know, leaking. But a lot of times it's just pay attention to the weather. And when it gets up to, you know, 35 degrees during the day and then freezes at night, that action really wakes up the roots and it starts drawing up the sap. And then when it starts to freeze, it'll push the sap back down. And that cycle is really what you want to hit. In some years, you know, you can have 8-12 weeks of that. In some years, you can have 1 week. And so it just is kind of one of those natural phenomenons that, you know, all plants do. And it just happens that maple trees produce kind of some of the tastiest, but you can do hickory trees, you can do birch trees, mm-hmm, you know, pretty much any hardwood that you want. They just have different ratios of sap to syrup and yeah.
Well, even, you know, maple trees from year to year will have some variation in that sugar content. And so you never quite know what kind of year it's going to be until you're, you know, finishing off that syrup. And actually a crazy thing, well, I think it's crazy. We lived in town. I mean, a small town in Wisconsin, if you're familiar, we were in Clintonville. But there were big enough maple trees between like us and our friends and a few other little places. But we tapped a bunch of the trees in town. And we were able to make syrup even just from in-town trees for us and our friends. And so that was a really unique experience for me.
Interesting. I didn't know you could do that. I didn't think there'd be enough trees to get that much sap. So how much on average, what do you think a tree produces for sap?
You know,
it depends on the length of the season, but
yeah,
let's say in 24 hours in a good push-pull cycle, like how much sap are you getting out of a, I don't know, average maple tree?
You know, you can get, you know, 4 to 8 gallons. It really depends on how often you empty it, because a lot of times, you know, life gets in the way and you have to go to work, and then you come home and you try and get it done, or you take some time off and you just do that for your job for a little bit. And you just, you know, dump out the buckets or dump out the bags. A lot of people will have big storage containers. Myself, we're planning just to boil it as we take it off the trees. So, you know, we're probably not going to put out a big amount of taps this year anyway. We're just going to see how the trees go. And yeah, I mean, you can get quite a bit in a day.
Well, and the other thing, you know, you're talking about the bags or the barrels and however people are collecting it. But I mean, if you're ever driving around Wisconsin, sometimes you'll even see people with like tubing running all through the trees. And you're like, what is going on there? And a lot of people will leave that up all year. Some people take it down and put it back up and everything, but they are connecting all those different taps through a tube system. And so instead of collecting those bags and everything, it kind of shoots it all the way down to wherever their sugar shack is. And that's a really unique thing, I guess. It takes a lot of work to do that. It's not for everybody, but that's the cool thing, is you tap as much as you want, you do as much as you want to kind of fit yourself. And I mean, it's a short-term hobby, so that's kind of nice. You don't have to invest all year long, but during that time, it takes the time.
And it really, you know, you really have the opportunity to get as fancy or as low-key as you want. You know, a lot of times just a wood stove and like an outdoor wood stove, you know, like a camping stove, and some steamer pans. You can do it just in there. Or, you know, like we went and bought an evaporator from a guy, and he a lot of these things are handmade. And that has like a 2x4 pan on it. And so like we'll fill up the pan, and when you get to be about an inch of water, you know, that's kind of where you want to keep it. And that's where you'll pull it off, and you'll get to a certain point. You'll see a certain color. There's something called a hygrometer, and that measures the sugar in the liquid. And so once you get all, you know, 100% sugar, you want to take it off, and then you're going to want to finish it either on gas or, you know, something outside. Like I like using a turkey fryer, just because, you know, you don't want to do any of this inside of your house. It'll make it produce the steam that comes off has different types of sugars, and it'll make your whole house sticky.
I hate to be the person that figured that out, right? Like you're walking around like, ugh.
Right?
like, ugh.
Yep.
But that's kind of why we're talking about, you know, it takes kind of a team of people, because I mean, you can do this by yourself. I mean, I'm sure there's somebody out there who is, but you know, it takes in some cases these big evaporator pans or turkey roasters. I mean, if you're going to do it solely that way, it takes a lot of time, but you know, these different steps in the process, you know, start to complete, it is, gosh, it, and because everything is so messy and so sticky, like you do almost want to do a lot at once, you know, make it worth it.
Well, tree sap's just sticky to begin with. And I'm sure, like, at least you're adding what you're probably making it slightly less sticky, I would assume, by adding the water and boiling it down. But I don't know. That's an assumption, because I feel like tree sap is way worse than maple syrup when it comes to stickiness.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's amazing where, you know, you turn this clear liquid, and you sometimes, you know, you'll get what we call ratios, right? So you'll get some trees that are pumping out sap water that's like 28 to 1. So that means 28 gallons of sap to 1 gallon of syrup. Well, average for a sugar maple is about 40 to 1. So like when you get those high sugar content trees, it changes from year to year. You know, some trees are just in a good spot, or they just do really well. But you can taste the sugar just in the sap. In some cases it just tastes like water. And so, you know, it's fun to watch it boil down, and it gets into this like kind of really light yellow color, and then it starts to caramelize, and then you start checking it. And once you get to that point that is almost syrup, but it still has, you know, maybe 20% or 25% water left, then you want to take it off and finish it on gas, because you can control that a lot better, and you're simmering it, and you just want to bring it down to like, I think it's like 16% or 14%. And that's where you get the syrup, where it pours like syrup. It looks, has that color. I know recently Vermont changed a lot of the grading system on how it's done. So like just like having a really light colored syrup or a really dark one, a lot of times doesn't matter. It just comes down to preference. or how you cook it, or like how much different minerals and stuff are in the water. It's just a really cool process, and it's fun because a lot of Wisconsinites do it as a family. And so, like, it's a big family outing, you know, uncles and grandpas and aunts and kids, like, they all take their turns, and you sit around the fire and you boil sap, and people rotate, you know, you keep the fire going 24 hours, or you stoke it up and go to bed and wake up in the morning and do that for a couple weeks. It's just a fun time.
And Wisconsin is rich with traditions. That's one thing I focus on in my show. Traditions, because traditions are more about the experience rather than a kill or something along those lines, or limits. I mean, you're really looking at the experience there, and that's just another way to keep people involved in the outdoors.
The 1911 is one of the most iconic firearms in history. Designed by John Browning, the 1911 was the standard issue sidearm of the U.S. military from 1911 to 1985. While Colt produced the original, almost every major firearm company has produced its own version. It's wildly revered for its reliability, crisp trigger, and is still a favorite for all types of shooters. Whether you're looking to buy or build a 1911 and just about everything for guns, log on to MidwayUSA.com. Hunting boots are a critical component of any successful hunt. Whether walking a short distance to your blind or trudging miles through rugged terrain, your feet are carrying the load. Without the right boots, you could give up early and lose out on that trophy just over the ridge. At MidwayUSA, we make selecting boots for your next hunt easier. With just a few clicks of a mouse, you can decide on what's important, like waterproofing, insulation, size, width, and savings. For just about everything for shooting, hunting, and the outdoors, check out MidwayUSA.com.
Yeah, and, you know, not that time of year, too, you can run into a lot of really cool stuff in the woods. You know, you can start seeing some of the critter signs changing into the spring pattern. You can start seeing some of the spring ephemerals, or those first plants in spring. All that stuff you start to recognize year after year. And you're like, oh, well, I'm walking through my yard and I see this popping up. I should probably get my tap stuff ready, you know, or something like that. So it's just really cool to be in touch with the outdoors from a really different perspective than just hunting and fishing.
Well, and this year is actually kind of, well, I think unique. I guess every year is unique in its own way. But, you know, some of the maple tappers have already started talking about doing that. You know, there's places where people put taps in. And I mean, sometimes when that weather fluctuates, they might have a little bit more of a season to come because, you know, it is so early. But I mean, it is kind of a cool thing, the weather this year too, because now we got all this snow. So maybe that kind of slowed things down for the maple season. But when you're collecting all this sap and everything, one of the things you have to remember to do, everyone's so ready to give up on winter, but if you can save some of that snow, like get a bucket of it and put it in the side of your garage where it like doesn't get, it's in the shadow, you know, it doesn't melt as much. And because you're going to want that snow to pack around if you have extra of the maple,
the sap.
Yeah. If you're going to store it before, like if your pan is full, what you're boiling on already. So that snow can be really helpful, but like you were talking about family, get kids to do that. They love to pile up snow, you know, but, just some fun things to remember as you're switching seasons.
It's just a great way to get, it gives you excitement, right? For that, just another way to be excited for spring. I know a lot of guys love turkey hunting and things like that, but this is before that even. Like, this is like, we're getting into that, like, end of February, beginning of March. I mean, you're not really into turkey season yet. You're coming, like, I mean, up north by you, you still got strong ice fishing. This year for us, not so much down here anymore. Our ice is, it's probably still fishable in some areas. I would probably just get the boat out and hit the river for walleyes at this point because it's wide open. Like,
Yeah. And that's, you know, that goes back to, you know, turkey season is right around the corner. And, you know, I personally don't really turkey hunt that much, but I really do love calling. And we do have, you know, we just purchased a new house in August. And so I'm still, both of us are still learning a lot about, you know, how the annual cycle of things around the yard goes. And it might just be fun just to go out there and sit with a slate and some camo and see, you know, we've seen them roosting in the fall. We haven't seen them, but you know, that's
right through the yard.
when you're tapping trees, you might be able to find that trail or find that roost tree and just be able to mark it for a month from now, you know?
Sure. Absolutely. Another fun thing walking around is like, got to keep your eyes out for sheds. I mean, you're yeah. right in that time of the year too. I mean, to shed hunt, it's just a great way to like bring more things into the outdoors. I do want to, before we move on, like, I guess I didn't know Vermont did the grading scale, but like, what is the grading scale? Like, is it color? Is it sweetness? Is it taste, consistency? Like, what are they, like, what are they grading maple syrup on? And are we talking like, is it grade A, B? Is it numbers? I'm curious. Like,
yeah, so that scale has a lot to do with taste and color. It's a standard for the industry. Vermont, you know, has a whole university dedicated to maple syrup. And so they do a whole lot, and you know, it sounds silly, but they do a whole lot of tree research and climate change research and a lot of stuff that impacts that industry, because it is a lucrative industry for big producers. Right. So we heard, a lot of us heard about Canada having a maple syrup shortage. And it's like, well, it's kind of funny when you say it out loud, but then all of a sudden you're like, wait, well, that sucks. Like, that goes in, not only is it just for pancakes, but it goes, you know, there's sugar, you know, that there's all kinds of candy and all kinds of stuff that a lot of those people miss out on. You know, it's kind of like not having snow here. For our snowmobile, for our bars and stuff up north, you know, when they don't have snow, it sounds funny, but bars don't get any business. So if you're having a shortage of maple syrup, there, you know, people get angry. And so that grading system, I don't know personally, because I don't really take it that serious, you know. I just try and get it as close to the percents. You know, there's a lot of information online. But if you look up Vermont maple syrup grading, like, they have a whole webpage devoted to just like explaining how they do it. And there's like double A and there's AB and AC or CB, or, you know, they really kind of they brought it from just like a very simple scale to something that, like, you know, includes the taste and the color and the texture. And so it's kind of fun, you know, to read about. Personally, that's too much. I got fishing and bees. And,
well, that's what I was going to say, is not to jump topics again, but, you know, as the spring comes up, that is the other thing that we think about. You know, we're talking about our different hobbies, and beekeeping is one of them. And so we're talking about the grading of the syrup, and it's a lot like grading of honey, you know, and that's kind of a trendy thing right now, bees, beekeeping, and honey. And so a lot of people have been to like honey tastings, or like at a fair, you try in a little spoon, and you know, that's very reminiscent of the syrup, because although they do have all the grading systems and everything, like, especially for people who do it in their home, like, what it comes down to is preference. And so it's like, people out there like, I only eat crappies, I only eat bluegills, or only from this season, whatever. And it's like, that's cool, but for us, we like maple syrup like this, you know. And so it's just cool to be able to choose that.
Well, and talk about an industry that's very tradition rich in Wisconsin. Our state insect is the honeybee. You know, the whole central part of the state is like the mecca of beekeeping. There's a world conference in Wausau every couple of years, if not every year, that where people from all over the world come and talk about honeybees, new techniques. And we've been doing it for quite a while now, you know, before the fad started. And there's a whole bunch to talk about. Like, we could do four shows on this beekeeping, but, you know, it's one of those things that we do. It's a passive hobby. It's really difficult. First off, I don't want to make it seem like you can just go like set up, because you know, there's some of those, depending on the way that you structure your hives and stuff, you know, some of those boxes can weigh 100, 120 pounds. And so you have to be ready to have to move that stuff around there. You know, for us this year, a new challenge is bears. We know we have bears in the area, so we have to pick a spot, level it out, put some electric fence around it. Normally they're not too much of a nuisance if you have an electric fence up. But if you don't,
my uncle did bees for many, many years. I don't remember what he taught at the university, but I know he taught at the university, and his father was an agriculture. He was an agriculture teacher as well. And I know he, even down not far from Madison, he has had bear issues with his bees.
Yes. Yeah, so one of our favorite people is Kent from Wapaka. They have the Dancing Bear Apiary. They have a awesome shop downtown Main
Main
Street.
Street, yeah.
And they just redid it. He has all kinds of different honey. And that guy, like him and some of the other people from that Wapaka chapter of beekeepers, they actually go down to South America and teach people how to keep bees down there.
In Nicaragua. Yeah,
Nicaragua. Yep.
interesting.
And so like he's a wealth of knowledge, and it's fun to go and hang out at his shop and
Taste the honey,
to,
like you were talking about.
But yeah, it's another passive hobby where we can, you know, we can have it here, we can check on it, we do the work, but then it, for the most part, it does for a lot of the season, it does itself. But in the spring and the fall, when traditionally you have a lot of transition, you know, we like to fill our time with stuff so ice buildup or ice out doesn't seem so long. We like to have those transition activities.
Sure, and that makes sense. You got your ice out period where you can't get out there in open water yet. Ice isn't safe. It's all honeycombed and whatnot. You're working on your maple
That's syrup
syrup,
season.
Yep.
right? That's syrup season. And then you got honey season there. I get that. I see it. I see the correlation there. I really do. But I guess I never like you're talking about like honey tastings, and I'm sure there's syrup tastings. Like I never even thought about that. And then like the judging of it, it's now I'm like, is this like whiskey and wine? Like I never
Yeah.
even put like that together. Like I'm sure there's I'm sure there's people out like you probably have to go through like so many tastings to get certified as a judge, and like it's a
Yep.
whole industry I never even thought of.
Yeah, we haven't delved much into that. That's way above our pay grade. But no, it's fun to keep track of and just watch and, you know, just keep up with it.
That's awesome. That's really cool. Wasn't expecting the first half of the show to go there. I like it.
Yeah.
But I know we
You
talked
never know
about
with us.
that's great though. You never know with my show. I mean, it could be anything on this show. Sometimes it's everything in the kitchen sink.
Yeah.
I know that we led to this a little bit, and I know I wanted to touch base on this. I know you guys shoot a little bit of archery, not a ton, but I know I've never shot league, so I'm kind of just curious on your opinion of like I know that's another probably winter activity. I'm assuming that's a wintertime activity you kind of use to keep your time busy. So I'm just kind of curious, like what led you to that? Like
So that was basically, you know, it was a bar league, and our friends are
we
currently
have to
in the
start like
league.
way sooner in the story than this.
Okay, sure. Start it off.
Okay. So I mean, I don't mean to interrupt, but it's like, I think the thing about it is you kind of grew up in the outdoors and hunting, and you had mentors, and as you grew up into an adult
I
man, am
mean,
I assuming?
yeah, you're assuming. Kind of. I mean, I spent a lot of my youth fishing. I got into college in Northwest Minnesota. I did a lot of waterfowl hunting, some upland game bird. I really didn't hit the bow scene until like my junior year in college. And, you know, I fell in love with, I've always loved, you know, bows. I'm kind of, I don't participate in a whole lot, but I'm kind of like the Dungeons and Dragons geek, you know. So, you know, the archery and stuff kind of lends itself to that. And I got into it and I started doing a little bit of hunting, just teaching myself, asking questions. And then I kind of fell away from it because I just started bouncing around the country and doing different jobs. And then once we kind of settled in Wisconsin, we kind of got back into it.
Well, and that's the other end of the story is that I grew up in Chicago. And so, when I was very young, we were closer to the city. And then after we were kind of more in the suburbs. But, convincing one of my friends even to go on a hike, much less go hunting, was just simply out of the question. Actually, I'll even admit this, we grew up, we didn't have like public land and stuff like that. We have forest preserves down there. And my experience with wildlife was like the deer, and you'd put the quarter in the gumball machine and you get the feed, and then they eat it out of your hand, like so when I moved to Wisconsin in college and met people who were hunting and outdoorsy and all of that kind of stuff, it kind of blew me away. And I loved it, but it was a lot at once, I suppose,
Culture
especially
shock,
first.
just culture shock. It's like a different country at that point.
And so when we met, and you were outdoorsy and I wanted to be, fishing kind of became our first thing, but then as we were seeking out those other hobbies, archery became it. And it's kind of a funny story because one day it was coming up to hunting season. Josh didn't know if he needed new strings on his bow. We stopped at the archery shop. And do you remember this story? He ended up not needing strings. They were in great shape. They were like, you're good for at least another season. We left there with a bow for me. Like, he asked me, he's like, are you interested? Do you want to shoot? And I just like said yes. So,
Yes,
I mean,
I
you know,
do.
we're talking about, you know, people getting interested and like trying these new things. And I mean, I think there are people these days, and I hate to say the C word, you know, but COVID, everyone is so locked up and now people are able to get out and do things again. But I think because everything feels so new, people are more willing to try new. And so obviously, I mean, this was before COVID that this all happened for me. And I guess I just decided to try it. But, you know, lo and behold, it was that day that I took my very first shots at a target. And, you know, growing up in a city, hunting is like a little bit hard for me. You know, I would have to really ease into that. But shooting at a target was super fun and ultimately something that I was half decent at, which was a really fun surprise. Like I had no idea.
That's and I didn't realize we had bar leagues in Wisconsin. I'm not surprised that we do. We have bar leagues for everything from darts to pool to foosball to like every literally everything. Bags tournament, like everything. There's a league for everything, softball, volleyball. I did not realize we had archery bar leagues. That's impressive.
Well, and that might be, and it might be something that's unique to the shop we were at, Butch's
Okay.
Archery, just south of Shawano. They have a full bar in their archery shop, and
Got it.
so you know that's kind of our the place we were shooting. We
And people
started,
are super respectful because you think of
yeah.
like bows and arrows and drunk people and like how does that all go? You know what I mean? But people are very respectful and I
Yeah, you
never
don't really
saw
have
it
a
be an
whole lot
issue
of
again in
time
my
to
situation. So
slam drinks when you're shooting because you have three or four rounds and you have to shoot, you know, 20 arrows a piece and there's 16 teams or 16 shooters and so like it can take, you know, you show up and have a something start at 7 and it might be, you know, 9:30, 10 o'clock before you're done.
sure, and you're pretty, and you're up there shooting quite a bit at that point. I mean,
Yeah.
it's I mean I'm sure there's some downtime as people cycle through, but it's not like you go up there, you shoot around, and then you wait around for 2 hours to see the results.
Right.
Well, and that's almost the funny thing because every night people have things going on in their lives, and usually you put that night aside. That's what that's for is, you know, shooting. But then there's always somebody who's like, I got to get home for whatever's going on. And so, you know, you all have to really cycle through. You don't just like shoot at your leisure. You know, there's lanes, you walk down together, you walk back together. You know, you're
Yeah,
not
it's
just
rules.
doing that. Yeah. And so, I mean, even though some people do kind of want to stand around and lollygag and whatever, there's always somebody there that's like keeping everyone on track. And that's pretty funny.
They got to go get their kid from basketball practice. So it's like, let's
Right.
go.
Yeah.
Come on. Let's go. I got my kid to pick up. Let's move. And
Yep.
I understand exactly what you're saying, like with the respectfulness, just because there's a bar there doesn't mean there's people standing around getting drunk and shooting each other. I mean,
Right.
you go to most sportsmen's clubs in Wisconsin for a clay league, sporting clay, trap, five stand, almost every place has a bar. Almost every single sportsman's club has a bar, and everyone there is very respectful for that. Most people don't like I've shot more rounds of clays than I can count, and we never drank beforehand. I mean, we'd go shoot a round of sporting clays or two back when I used to shoot league for sporting clays. Afterwards, we'd have a couple beers, sure, but we never do it before we'd go shoot. I probably should have, like, I probably would have had better scores. It's like darts, you need just enough aiming fluid,
Yep.
but we were always respectful of the firearms, and we never did.
Yeah. And so, you know, with the archery, you know, we didn't, she says we walked in and got a brand new bow for her, and that's true, but you don't have to go in and spend $1,500 on a brand new bow for somebody that's new. You know, we went in, we bought a Diamond Youth bow. It was bright green. We still have it. It's a great bow
I
fishing
like it
bow
still.
because you can turn it way down. And she, you know, she shot with it. And what took a little bit of time was her being able to recognize like your feet per second increases your accuracy. So even though it's an easy bow to draw back and it's a very forgiving bow, you're lobbing arrows down 20 yards instead of shooting arrows down 20 yards. And so we did end up going and getting her a Vixen. I shoot like the Hoyt Defiant, the
Oh
carbon
my God.
Defiant.
Yeah, Power Max.
And I was really in love with my 2019 Rock by Diamond, and it got stolen out of my pickup. So that was why I had to buy a
Oh.
new bow. But it was good. Like
Surprising it's locked.
Yeah.
It like broke in to take it.
But I mean, you know, it is what it is. It wasn't worth a whole lot. It was just something that I was comfortable shooting, but I switched over to the Defiant. Maybe some of your viewers know, like, that's a very long bow, axle to axle. We actually just got some cases from Lakewood that are 43 inches, and this like maxes that out. I think it's like 39 and a half or something axle to axle. And so it's like a pretty long bow. But for me, like, especially having a short draw length, you know, I'm shooting 26 inches, having that really long axle to axle, gives me a lot of forgiveness when I'm hunting. You know, I can be off just a little bit. You know, I practice a lot in the yard with the season coming up. You know, we normally do some leagues during the winter, so it's not like I'm totally cold. But I just getting out and using it. And if you want to get into archery, like that, I think that diamond youth bow was like 150 or $200 with a sight and a whisker biscuit on it.
You don't need anything more than that. I mean, my first, like, I still have my first bow, which is a super old Bear Legion too, like really old. I still have it. And then from there, I went to, I don't remember what it was. It was another Bear, but it was a ready to hunt. I got it on sale, I think, at Gander for $325.
Nice.
And it had a True Glow sight, whisker biscuit, took it to a local bow shop and had them go through it. And we got the peep sight set up and everything right. So I shot it great. The only reason I got rid of it is because I became super focused on upland bird hunting and I completely threw archery to the side.
Yeah.
Knives, machetes, saws, and shears, multi-tools, shovels, swords, axes, spears, hatchets, and tomahawks. If it cuts, snips, slices, or chops, Midway USA has it. Find great gift ideas in our huge selection of pocket knives and other everyday carry folding knives. Make a statement or create a family legacy with one of our top-of-the-line hunting knives. We've got a great selection of manual and electric sharpeners, too. For just about everything for the outdoors, check out MidwayUSA.com. At Midway USA, we know the AR-15 is one of the most popular rifles in modern American history. Known for its modularity and widespread use, it's often considered essential to any gun collection. The essential things you need to run an AR-15 are usually always in stock during shortages, things like magazines and 5.56 ammo. Whether you're looking to buy a new AR-15 or buy parts for your modern sporting rifle, log on and for just about everything for the outdoors, shop MidwayUSA.com.
Yeah, and that's kind of the different story for me. You know, I came from hunting the Dakotas, western side of Minnesota. You know, there's grouse and pheasants and ducks galore out there, and then I come here and it's like a good day on the pond is like a half a dozen mallards or 12 wood ducks, you know? And it's like,
sure.
It's really difficult. Like I'll be the first to admit, I was like super spoiled living in anybody that lives in the Dakotas and waterfowl and upland game hunts. They're super spoiled. You don't know what you have until you're missing it. But, you know, but that's kind of where I transitioned from shotguns into archery and started focusing more on bow hunting. And, luckily I work in natural resources and all the guys in my office are all archery hunters. So, you know, we can break down maps. We can look, you know, we'll have people over to our properties and we'll look at stand locations and be able to collaborate during the day when we're working or whatever. And it's just very helpful and good way to learn from people that have been doing it their whole life, you know?
Sure. I mean, not everybody can look at a map or like a topo map or any map and figure out like exactly what they're looking at, what would be a choke point, what's different funnel areas. I'm not great at that. I'm not a big archery and deer hunter though either. You were spoiled out there for your upland birds. My father-in-law has 40 acres, which the past 2 years I have had my deer within the first 15 minutes.
Nice.
I'm not a big archery hunter because I don't like to sit. Like I don't like sitting in a tree stand. I don't like for me, that's too slow. I can't get out of my own head and I wound up reverting back to like what I have to do at work and planning work stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas like when I'm fishing or I'm upland hunting or duck hunting, which I do most like things that involve my dog, I'm able to truly focus on the moment, focus on the dog, and literally wash all that stuff out of my brain. And that's why I go out to do this, because I want the break from real life. I want to be 100% immersed in the activity I'm currently in. And I just can't find that in archery. I can't get out of my own way when sitting in a tree stand.
Well, maybe that's why leagues is like perfect for you. You know, it keeps that pace going. You're always shooting at something, or there's some really fun 3D shoots out there. I mean, some places just like put a deer out there and say, go for it, you know, but some of these places have really elaborate setups, sound systems, ambiance, you know, it's all set up. And explore some of those places, because there is some cool stuff going on.
Oh, I've seen some amazing 3D. Like, I know, like, there's a local bowl shop, Buck Rub. They've got a really nice indoor 3D, and they got a really cool 3D like walk through the woods area. And like that was always fun. It's just finding the passion, like, because I don't hunt. Like I hunt. That's like my main passion, right? But I don't archery hunt. And for me, it's like, do I want to drive 40 minutes to go shoot, or would I rather drive 10 minutes to the local park and work my dog? And I'd much rather go work my dog. Like, I feel like fall is way too short also. So I have to select what I want to do. Do I want to chase deer in the fall, or do I want to spend like the beginning of September and all of October and up until deer season, basically in November, chasing my dog around the woods looking for grouse and woodcock, which is what I do. And then I gun deer as quick as possibly I can to fill my freezer. And then my dog goes away because it's gun season, it's too dangerous. And then I focus on that last 2 weeks of ducks. Like, it's all mapped out like every year. And it's like, short of my dog getting hurt, I just don't pick up my bow.
You know what I'm thrilled to hear about all of those hunting options? Seriously, I love hunting because it keeps people off the lake in fall. And that is the best fishing that there is.
Yeah, I'm not chasing the fall bite. Like, I'm a big bass fisherman. Everybody's like, you got to get in the fall bite. Like, I'm catching bass. He's like, I've got the muskie. I just caught 240 plus. I'm like, yo, man, I'm shooting grouse in the woods. Like, you have had that. I'm good.
And I am so glad that you were out there doing that.
I mean, I love fishing. Like, I love fishing the summer. I love chasing smallies. Like, I'm a huge fan of chasing smallies on the Wisconsin River. Like, that's really where I did quite a bit of tournament fishing last year, and I really enjoy chasing smallies on the river. So I really see myself slowing down on the tournaments this year, maybe fishing only one or two rather than fishing a full weeknight series every single week all summer, and really just going back to the river and just like slowing down and just catching them river smallies, because they're just so mean. I love them.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I mix up my archery. I do that after work. So during the week is my bow time, but Saturday and Sunday is reserved for fishing. So.
And I think that also has a big thing to do with why I don't shoot anymore. I used to be able to shoot in my yard. I now live in a subdivision just outside of the second biggest city in Wisconsin. And my basement's 13 yards, not even, it's 11 yards. Like, I used to shoot, I'm like, this is boring. Like, 11 yards, this is just like, it's not even worth it. Like, it's not, I mean, I keep the muscle memory, sure, but like, I'm not actually pushing myself to be better in any sort of way. And the closest place, like the closest sportsman's club for me, is over 30 minutes away. So for me to have an hour worth of driving to go shoot 40 or 50 arrows, it just, I can't, like, it's too much. Like, I can't, I can't justify the time spent for it anymore is really what it is, just because of my location.
Well, and I was going to kind of like make fun of you a little bit, like, what, your neighbors don't like you like shooting across the backyards and stuff, you know, but I mean, it brings you to a bigger thought, is that even before I met Josh, he was doing a little bit of bow hunting, or bow fishing, I guess. Where you, in the town you were in, Shawano, not to throw Shawano under the bus, you know, but he was stopped a few times. Like, you can't bow hunt in the city. And it's like, no, I get it. But I'm like, shooting at the lake, you know, like in a place where nobody else is, you know, you take the precautions and all of that. And some That's people, funny. It's really hard to find a place to get out and do some of these outdoor sports.
Like, not to throw Shawano under the bus, but they're already under the bus now at this point. Like, were these local homeowners saying you can't hunt in there?
No,
was like, this
no,
actually, I got like the police no, came
I was,
and said.
I was discharging my bow fishing bow within 30 feet of the center line. And, you know, it's a weapon, so you All can't right. do that. That's part of the laws. But the reason I never got a ticket was that nobody could ever explain to me whether my bow fishing rig was a bow or a harpoon. And harpoons aren't covered in natural resource law. The arrow itself, the shaft, doesn't have fletchings. It's connected to the bow itself, so it's all one unit. And, you know, northern, north central city cops, they, you know, they probably went to school there, high school there, and then they graduated and became a cop, and they just don't want to deal with it. So they're just like, hey, we keep getting calls of somebody shooting off a bridge. You can't do that. And I go, well, I can, and I'm going to. But then I just finally came up and gave up just because it wasn't even that good. And there's a lot of rocks, so I ended up busting a bunch of arrows. But
it just kind of surprised me, because if you would go out on the Madison chain on a warm Saturday night, like I'll go out there in spring and troll. Like, I've got a duck boat, but I'll set it up for trolling. Like for walleye out there, and I'll be out there in the spring trolling, and like when the carp are like getting ready to spawn, and it's all you see is bow fishing boats on that lake at night.
Yep.
You either have lighted planer boards, you're either trolling for walleyes, and it's a big loop that everybody basically does. Like, yep. You're on the Madison chain, you know what I'm talking about. There's one, but all around you is nothing but spaceships.
Yep.
With bow fishing boats. So I was surprised to hear you were getting harassed up there, because like they don't like. Not like they shoot the crap out of these lakes.
Well, and I do have a slight advantage, you know, being in natural resources. I have some access to information that most normal people don't, so I can look up rules and regulations a little bit more efficiently than some people. But you know, it you just have to pick your battles, and that was one that I just kind of gave up on.
I get it completely. Like, is it, like, there's so many different ways you can argue that. Is it even worth the argument, right? I get that.
If it was good bow fishing, I would have probably put up more of a stink, but it wasn't. So
I've always had fun doing that from my kayak. Like, that's always been fun. Like, yeah. you get out there with the right water color on a nice on a day where you have enough wind where it pushes the kayak, but not enough wind to ruin your sight. You're like the water clarity, it's great, because like you can just set up on a drift and you can just float right over them. They don't even care.
Yeah.
There's no sound. There's nothing. There's no trolling motor. The wind just blows you, and my kayak's stable enough. I can stand to shoot the whole time, and it's like it's a good time.
Yeah, that's fun.
We keep talking that we got to get kayaks, so I'm sitting here just like listening jealously, basically. But I'm also laughing because I think even anglers so often focus on like the deep water, or you know, where are fish, or this or that drop offs, and I think they fail to realize how many fish are up shallow, you know, how many carp are in your local waterways, just some of these different creatures that are up there that you only see bow fishing. You know, it's kind of like two different sports, but you know, on the same water, and it's crazy that it is so different.
It's amazing what you'll see bow fishing on lakes. It is absolutely amazing. I remember going out on a well-known musky lake in Wisconsin. I'm not going to say any more specific than that. And we were talking to the guy out there, and this was before lithium was even popular. And he's out there with a really nice, like, it was not your typical, it wasn't a John boat. I don't remember what kind of boat it was, but I'm like, that's a unique boat to do bow fishing, and it was 100% quiet. He was running all lithium batteries with lights, and this was before LED was even out. Like, he was running all HPS, before that got popular, all lithium battery. I'm like, he had lots of money because this lake was somewhat not, it wasn't real rural, and it's like generators could make people frustrated, and he's like, you wouldn't believe the walleye in this lake. I'm like, there's not walleye in this lake. What are you talking about? And he's like, you come out with me one night, I will show you walleye bigger than you can imagine in this lake. And nobody knew they were in there, really. Other than unless you were out there at night and he was up in the shallows and the walleyes come into the shallows to feed. And that lake had really good clarity.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's awesome.
That is awesome.
So like you were saying, like, it's surprising, like, people guys think sometimes don't get out of their own way.
like what you're saying, because I have friends that are big bass, like I'm a big bass fisherman, and I'll chase deep water fish, I'll fish ledges, I'll try to find that big bite, and they're big, and there can be big bites out there. But I'll have a friend call me fishing from her mom's pier. I just caught a 22. What? You just caught a 22 inch bass from your mom's pier, like in the sloppiest slop that I'm like, how'd you even fish that? Like, what do you even throw yeah. through there? Like I'm surprised you can't walk across that to get to clean water. It's so thick. It's just like, wow, like really? And she'll be like, yeah, oh yeah, I caught a like a handful over 16, this 20 incher today. I'm like, what am I doing out here? Like,
that's so
like
cool.
Why am I chasing this fat smallie bite when I can be in there not dealing with offshore traffic from boats and just be yeah. tucked up in some shallow punching some mats?
Yeah.
That is true.
Brave anglers search for the one they call king, but who will take his throne? Tune in to Waypoint TV's Battle for Silver, Saturday, May 18th from 12 to 6 p.m. Eastern, presented by Abyss Battery. Waypoint TV.
I also like what you said about, like, don't let people get in your own way, because, you know, when we're talking about the outdoors, I think that's the other thing is people hear, I mean, we're online, we're talking about what we do or don't do, you know, but people get so caught up in that. And so it's really important to, like, listen to stuff like this and every other episode or, you know, whatever else people are putting online, but, you know, only like listen halfway, I guess, you know, like learn something from each of these things, but you have to do things your own way. And you were talking about smallies, and that's what made me think of this. We were out on Mille Lacs, I guess that's almost 2 years ago now. It was fall, and honestly, the walleyes were not biting that great, but we know that there's smallies in there. And so we tried every bass bait that we had with us. You're supposed to do this, throw like this, do this, you know, found, because we're not primarily bass anglers, but we were doing what you have to do. And then we're like not catching them. We're like, screw this. And then we put on, we troll for panfish all the time. So we just started like trolling different swim baits and stuff. And I kid you not, we caught so many smallies. And part of that is just like the confidence in that technique, you know? And so sure. whether it's hunting, whether it's bow leak, whether it's fishing, whether it's bow fishing, you know, whatever it is, like that's one of the things is like find your niche and find your groove. And that's kind of what this is all about.
It's amazing what a confidence lure can do. Like it really is. And I mean, you just said that, like that was your confidence, like trolling, and you were able to pinpoint them fish. But it's like, it's amazing what a confidence lure will go to. It's funny because I always like, I'll bring six rods with for a bass tournament and everything else. And I'll bring even more when I'm out pre-fishing, trying to figure out what the bite is and the pattern is. And if I lose the pattern, there's two baits I'm going back to, and I know right where I'm going to throw them. It doesn't matter what I found pre-fishing anymore, because if I can't find the fish, like I know this is going to catch fish. So it's like what you said, like, why don't I just start there? Like, if this is my go-to and I know it works everywhere, why am I doing anything but that? Like, I really feel like I could bring like six bags of plastics and two rods and really just like fish as good as I fish like with everything else I bring.
Yeah, but if you never tried anything new, like think of all the things you would miss out on learning. Because that's the other fun thing is like, if we went out and we could like find deer every time, we could catch a fish every time, fish fry, and you know, like, I hate to say it, you know, nobody maybe wants to say it, but sometimes those days where the bite is really hard and it's a really humbling day, you know, you try your confidence baits and even that doesn't work. You know, that's what makes those days so great, when you can just slam on fish or, you know, find a trail or whatever sport that it is. I mean, because if every day was perfect, then it would be boring.
For sure. I agree 100%. And sometimes those really hard days are really like really are what pay off at the end. Cause I remember, had to have been late summer last year. It was one of our weeknight tournaments in the kayak, and it was a super slow bite, like really, really slow. And I went to a spot where I thought I'd catch fish. I couldn't find them. It was really windy. It was nasty. I put all my dice into going across the lake to this spot. Like I had waves coming over the bow the whole way there. Like it was rough. It was a rough day. And like, I'm like, ah, it's not working. Like I'm sending pictures to all the rest of the paddle and fin crew. Like there's a sitting right next to me is a raccoon that came out of the reeds, and I'm texting pictures. I'm like, one of the guys' nicknames is Trash Pan. I'm like, hey, wait, man, next time you crash my, tell your friends that not to crash my party. And like, I'm like completely out of it right during this tournament. And I'm like, all right, I got to focus. And I went to a bait that I just started to try to use, and it was a jig and worm.
And I pitched it in next to this tree and I got bit like instantly, like right off a deep hole. And I'd already fished this spot once. I wound up catching three fish out of there, putting all three in the boat. That's my only three bites. And it was enough to take first.
Nice.
Like, so it's like, I couldn't figure anything out. I couldn't focus. And like, it was really frustrating. And then like, I got those three bites. That's the only bites I had. And it's a three fish limit. So I got my limit in this tournament as a three fish rather than a five, like most kayak tournaments. And I was able to take first that night, and it was a rough night. And I'm like, this was awesome. Like, it really made, like you were saying, like sometimes that difficult period really can make it like just that much better the next time, or even in the same day, once you figure it out. And even if you don't really figure it out, you're struggling all day and you get just a couple of good bites, it really makes it worth it.
Yeah. I mean, that's something where I feel like, you know, cameras on both land and water are really important. You know, as far as I'm concerned, I think that just having the verification that you're right, you know, you might sit in a tree all day and not see anything, and then the next day, the one you were looking for walks by at the time you would have been there, but at least you know he's there, right?
Right.
And so that goes same with fishing. You know, you, as long as you have a camera and you do all the things right, and you can't get anything to bite, and you're like looking at your electronics and you're like, man, maybe these are just like shiners or something, and you put it down there and it's like, you know, that giant school of smallmouth or a big school of crappies, right, or whatever, and like you feel vindicated, right? So at least you can, sure, go home and not feel like it was a disappointment. You learned something.
Find them.
You learned something, right? You went, right, through all of those things that you tried didn't work. And now you just put them together with those pieces, like the weather and, you know, your cadence. And this applies to almost all the outdoor pursuit to stuff. You know, you just put all those pieces together, and then next time you can set yourself up to be successful in the way that you want to be successful.
Absolutely. I mean, every time I'm out there, I'm learning something. I mean, I'm always trying to learn. It's always what worked, what didn't work, like with grouse hunting, like time of year, weather patterns, what were they feeding on? Like if you're able to harvest a bird, looking at the crop, like what are they feeding on? What time of day are you finding them? And what kind of cover are you finding them in that time of day? Is it really hot? Are they lowland? Are they wet? Are they in swamps? Is it kind of cool? Or, I mean, all of that. And every time I go out, I'm always like, okay, what did I do different here? Like what was different? What worked? What didn't work? Same with fishing. So I think that's a big part of it for me, is the constant learning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, one kind of last thing that we do as far as our fishing and some of the hunting goes, like we've devoted a whole room in our house to tackle craft, building rods, like MacGyvering stuff to make our escapades out in the wilderness like a little bit more fun. And it's learning how those things, you know, interact in the water and learning how like certain things work. You know, I take a lot of inspiration from the bass world. Japan's been doing it for a long time and they've been micro-sizing stuff. And I just really love taking the challenge of taking like an Alabama rig and turning it into like a crappie rig, even a bluegill rig, sure, you know, a swarm of little bugs on there. Who knows? Because those kind of things like keep you engaged, and you might find that golden thing that like
your new favorite lure.
Yeah.
Your new confidence. Right.
Well, someone came up with a vibrating jig, right? That wasn't, yeah, around 10 years ago. 10
right.
years ago, it was a spinner bait or a buzz bait. And all of a sudden, what's this vibrating jig? Like someone came up with that. Someone decided to put a flat blade in front of a jig one day and was like, holy crap, this is amazing.
Yep. Yep.
Or like before, like with musky baits, before they had those really giant bucktails and synthetics, like with the big Carolina blades. Back then, I was bit by the musky bug and we were making our own lures. Like we were making huge Carolina blades on 5-inch vices and hammering them out with hammers, like to the point where we were blowing up like the old school Abu Garcia 6300s, like at least a couple of season. But these fish had never seen a lure put out this much vibration.
Yeah.
And the amount of follows we got, because they were just like, I don't even know what this is. I'm going to investigate. was like, you knew you were on the right path. And now you've got like the showgirls and the cowgirls and the doubles and the, like, it's like they're the market caught up, but for a while there, nobody knew what we were doing. Like we were throwing like big, like that's back when the Meps muskie killer was a big bucktail, and we're making things 3 to 4 times that size.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or like when the bulldog came out for muskies, like giant plastics, and they're like, and like they're hammering fish because they've never seen it before.
Right.
I'm laughing a little bit because I'm trying to not like get into a huge story while we're like kind of summing things up. But when, you know, we just recently moved in August, and we ended up, so if you've heard of the Suic Lure Company, we ended up in the Suic house. So like, welcome. But we found like a few little Easter eggs and things around the house that have to do, you know, with kind of the history of the company. And so Josh actually went online and found like one of the oldest versions of a Suic lure. And we also in this process had picked up a very new version of a Suic lure because it happens to be on their website. It's signed by all the family members. So as far as the history of the house, it was really cool. But to be able to have like this very old original version and like this brand new version. And I mean, that is really cool, but the technology difference, I mean, it's hard to call a lure technology, but that is what it is, you know, and to see that evolution along the way. I mean, and we, you were talking about the tackle crafting even, I mean, that's the thing, anybody can come up with the next big idea, you know? Yeah, and so right. Like we were saying, going out there and trying something new, you never know what's going to work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the cool part. Like, it doesn't even take much. Like, well, we'll pick on the vibrating jig because it was easy, right? Someone put a flat blade in front of a bass jig.
Yeah.
Changed the complete style of the lure. Like, someone decided to do that one day, and it was probably some random person, to be honest, and it worked, right?
Oh.
I mean, I don't even know what the next big idea is. I don't know. I haven't thought of it yet. I might not be the one to even think of it. Someone's going to be like, you know, look at the Alabama rig. Like,
yeah.
Like someone thought of throwing a whole bunch of shiny, flashy stuff with a whole bunch of hooks and baits on it. Like, let's make it look like a swarm of shad. Like,
mm-hmm.
Or what is that? That deep jigging technique they came out for ocean now for ocean fishing. They've got some like they've got a whole different style of slow jigging.
Yep.
Like that's like its own unique thing too. Like someone came out like with that and the presentation and the baits for that or giant swim baits now. Like it's all like. There's all these new things coming out, which it's cool. It's like you said, anybody can get into that too and just try those unique things and see what works.
Yeah. And, you know, people shouldn't be scared to cross over into different, you know, different categories. I take a lot of stuff from, you know, my hunting background and bring it into fishing and vice versa. You know, we were talking about reading maps, and that's one thing that like, animals just follow the same thing, you know, the sure. path of least resistance. They're just, animals are like water. And sometimes, you know, you get a weird one that like runs straight up a hill or, you know, whatever, but you take all that knowledge and you can like put it together and just really mash up all of your experience from all facets of the multiple industries and really make yourself successful.
That is the good part. That's the fun part about it. I mean, it's just all that was learning, just taking knowledge from everywhere you can. And like you said, take it with a grain of salt, but like take that knowledge and find a way to make it work for you.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to give you two the last few minutes of the show here. Talk about what you all do. Shout out Crappie Junction and everything else you got going on. Thank whoever you need to thank. And
let's start by thanking your viewers at home, right? Yeah. Because without them, none of us would be here. And, you know, if you'd like to continue to join us on the things that we do and talk about and all of that, we love to share out mostly the fishing world. But we do some of this other stuff and we like to share that too. But Crappie Junction, we are on most of your favorite social media platforms. And crappies are indeed our favorite, but we are multi-species angler and fish all kinds of different locations. We like to travel here and there and all those kinds of things. So different adventures, including expos. So especially this weekend, we have coming up the Wisconsin Fishing Expo down in Madison. So if you are in that area, definitely look that up this weekend. Lots of fabulous things going on, but we like to do live videos with different vendors and stuff to bring the show and the expo to the people who can't be there. So you see a lot of that from us. But I guess for that show specifically, if you can make it, they do prizes as well. So just for showing up, you are eligible to win. And so, you know, just sharing all that kind of stuff that we experience with everyone else. That's what we do.
Yeah.
I love it. And the Wisconsin Fishing Expo is a great show. Like you said, they've got prize patrol that goes around. I will be there in the Rocktown booth representing New Canoe. So if you are in the area and want to meet me in person, stop by the Rocktown booth. You'll see these two walk you'll see these two walking around if you're there at the right time. So I hope to see some people out. I think it's one of my favorite shows. I really do enjoy that show.
Yeah, it's very fun. The advertising company does a really wonderful job. And we, you know, we love working with them. And, you know, kind of our thing is just weeding through the information, weeding through the products, and just kind of recommending what works for us while also giving you an idea of what else is out there. And so don't just take our advice and get everything that we get, because a lot of times it might not work for you. And so that's kind of what we base ourselves on, is getting the information out there and helping people.
Trying to be impartial, but partial at the same time. Like, this works for us, but theirs is out here as well. Like, feel free to use it.
Yep.
I like it. And I will link, and I'll provide all their links in the show descriptions to all their different social media platforms and anything else they have going on. So you'll be very easy to find them. I'll tag them in the show, like always. Emily and Josh, I really appreciate you coming on. It's been a fun show.
Yeah, anytime.
Yeah.
I learned quite a bit about maple syrup, which was very surprising. I liked it.
There's a lot more to learn.
Oh, I'm sure there is. I'm sure there is. To all my listeners, thanks again for tuning in. I wouldn't do this without you. And until next time, everyone, keep chasing the experience.
Legendary shows in the outdoors is on Waypoint TV. Don't miss Primo's Truth About Hunting, Wednesday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.
Four in the morning.
Join me, Chef Jean-Paul Bourgeois, and the whole crew here at Duck Camp Dinners every Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV.
Birds up in the sky.